This is Radio Boston. I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. The smartphone is a many-splendored thing, part phone, part web browser, part GPS, part personal organizer. In fact, we now expect our phones to help us in just about all of our daily routines.
But now smartphones are actually changing those routines. And in doing so, smartphones are beginning to take on roles traditionally held by, you know, people. Diet coach, exercise instructor, therapist.
In the smartphone app development sector, there's a growing field of apps dedicated to changing your behavior for the better. There are apps designed to help you lose weight, exercise more, sleep better, even be more environmentally conscious. And many of these apps are being developed right here in the Boston area.
But can your phone really change who you are? Do you even want your phone to do that? We're going to talk about the developing field of behavior modification apps. And listeners, we'd love to hear from you. What are some of the apps that you use to help change your habits? Have you encountered any success with that? Or are they just taking up memory space? What kinds of behaviors would you like to see apps designed for? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And joining us today to talk behavior and technology is Stephen Intilli, a professor of computer and information science and of health sciences at Northeastern University. He's starting up a doctoral program there in personal health informatics. Professor Stephen Intilli, welcome.
Thank you.
And we should say that, you know, this is sort of a big area of development for Boston. Companies like Lose It, Run Tracker are based here, and I think we'll probably talk a little bit about why that is later on. But for the time being, you specialize remarkably in this thing called health informatics. What does a typical weight loss app do? How does it work?
So a weight loss app would try to employ theories of behavior change that have been around for a long time, things like getting people to understand what they do, track what they do, think about their decision-making processes. But then it would try to do that on a daily basis in a way that a person couldn't, because they can't be with you all the time. So your app is there. It's there when you're eating. It's there when you're exercising. If you can get a little bit of information into it, then it can provide little bits of feedback back to you and try to help you make behavior changes that you're interested in making.
Well, at the dawn of man before the iPhone, a common way to get control over one's weight was to start keeping track of what one was eating in a journal of some kind. How is mobile technology improving on that essential practice?
Well, one of the harder areas is actually understanding what you're eating or tracking what you're eating. So we know that if people track what they eat, then they'll typically lose. It's a good strategy for losing weight.
Yeah, just the act of recording
it
makes you think,
recording.
Oh, man, I don't want to have to write this down later, because then I'd have to acknowledge it to myself.
Yeah. And you understand that that thing that you just ate was 1,000 calories or 1,500 calories, and you're only supposed to have, you know, 2,000-something calories. So the convenience of the phone application is that you can track, but then it can give you a summary of what you did in some compelling way. So that could just be adding up the calories you ate for the day and telling you how many you have left. So you don't have to do, essentially have to do the math on paper, and also showing you what you did last week versus what you did this week. So it's really just making it more convenient when it comes to diet tracking. In other areas like physical activity measurement, they may actually be able to truly measure it without you having to do so much work.
Sure, but back to the sort of the menu tracking, I've heard that there are some people even looking at apps where you could like take a picture of your dinner plate and it might have some kind of algorithm for counting up the calories. That would be fantastic.
Yeah. So there's two things happening, I think. One is something that's semi-automated. So you might take a picture of your food and send it off to the crowd, other people who might then label what's in the food. And then the other thing is researchers who work in computer vision, and some of this is funded by the National Institutes of Health, where you take a picture of the food and the computer tries to figure it out automatically what's on that plate. How much is there? What is it and how much is there?
So when you think about all of the weight loss and health apps that are out there right now, what are the most successful models that come to mind for you? What's really working?
Well, I think for some people, some of the weight loss applications can work very well. So Lose It and Noom and Run Tracker, things like that. When people use them, I think they can work. And they're very inexpensive. You download them for just a couple dollars or for free, and people can make progress. I don't think the evidence is there yet that for the people who need the most help, who might be less inclined to do any tracking in the first place, that those apps are necessarily going to work. And so I think that's where there's a lot of interesting research to be done in terms of how we take things that we know people do like, games and other things, and make this type of stuff sustainable for long periods of time.
Let's take a call straight away. Kathy is calling from Westwood, and you're using an app called My Net Diary. What's that?
This is an awesome app that I downloaded on my iPhone to help me track the calories, manage how many calories I should have. Like, you set up a plan for how to lose weight, and it helps you check the calories. It helps you monitor your exercise, and it's been really informative for me, and I've lost 17 pounds since the beginning of April.
Congratulations on that. Can you give me a more specific idea of what it does for you that other methods haven't?
Well, when I'm trying to track my food, it gives me many different ways to measure it. I can measure it in grams, I can measure it in cups, I can measure it in servings. It allows me to take pictures of the barcodes. Like, if I'm having a cereal, I just scan the barcode and it takes all the nutritional information in. And then it analyzes by day and by week what nutrients I've been eating, whether I've been eating too much fat, whether I've been eating too much or the right amount of fiber or whatever. And these are things that, like, I thought I was eating pretty healthy, but
no.
When I looked at the analysis, I was like, oh, that's where I'm making my mistake.
Yeah.
It's the power of information, really.
The power of information to depress us occasionally, but I'm glad that you've experienced success, and way to go, and keep chugging away. Kathy from Westwood, thank you so much. We're talking about apps that help you to modify your behavior, and obviously we're kind of starting at the obvious, which is health and weight loss, but it gets into much more diverse areas, as we shall soon see. But we'd be delighted to hear about your experience with apps, anything that you've found to work for you or maybe hasn't worked for you in terms of using your app to modify your own behavior. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I want to talk about an area now where this technology sort of could be headed in the future. Some Boston area researchers have been exploring ways in which smartphones could be used to treat social anxiety problems. And one of those researchers is Richard McNally. He's a professor and director of clinical training in the psych department at Harvard University. He's the author of several books, including What is Mental Illness? And he joins us now from his office at Harvard. Hi, Professor.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. You've been using mobile technology for what's called cognitive bias modification. Can you start by explaining what cognitive bias is?
Yes. Myself and many other researchers a few years ago had discovered that people with anxiety problems tend to have what is called an attentional bias for threat. And translating that into English, what that amounts to is that people who are prone to anxiety tend to focus on moderately threatening kinds of things. They tend to ruminate about these things. They sort of, their attention and their mind sort of locks onto this.
So kind of like, you know, you hear somebody snickering and you think that they're laughing at you.
Absolutely, right. And so a person who's socially anxious may enter a party with a lot of strangers, and rather than sort of connecting with those individuals who appear welcoming and friendly, they tend to notice people are looking slightly contemptuously at them or appear bored, things like that. And so they focus on these moderate threats, which then sets them on sort of a downward spiral of becoming very self-conscious, very anxious. And so this attentional bias for threat, as we call it, sort of sets them off in the wrong direction. Now, it turns out that this happens to be something that's commonly associated with anxiety. It may actually put people at risk for anxiety. So the idea is, if we could take these experimental cognitive psychology procedures that we've studied in the laboratory and tweak them a little bit, we might be able to retrain the brain, if you will, retrain the cognitive bias so people can disengage their attention, so they can focus on things that are not so threatening and that are more positive or neutral, and thereby prevent that negative cascade.
So how will my smartphone help me to do that?
Well, what we did is that we took some, and the we in this case, let me emphasize, is my PhD student, Phil Enoch, who's the first author on this project, myself and my colleague at Boston University, Stefan Hoffman. What we did is to take the program that we've used in the laboratory, that is on desktop computers, and simply transfer it to the iPhone. And what this program involves, essentially, it's a very simple sort of procedure. The person sees on the screen two faces of photographs of the same person, one face displaying sort of a contemptuous, disgust-like expression. The other face is either neutral or positive. These faces appear simultaneously for half a second, very quickly, and then they are replaced by what's called a probe, a capital E, or capital F, and the subject's task is merely to press a button indicating was that an E or was that an F. Now, what happens is in the assessment procedures, you'll find that subjects who are very socially anxious, their attention gets captured by these sort of contemptuous facial expressions, and they're very, very fast. The reaction time is very fast to identify whether that's an E or an F if the probe follows that negative face. That's the attentional bias right there, as demonstrated in the laboratory. So what we do is simply have the probes follow the neutral or the positive faces in such a way that sort of retrains this bias. And so we did this in the laboratory, as have others.
Well, let me hold you here. So basically, yeah. the happy face will flash at me, and then it'll go away, and then in its place will be an E or an F, and then I have to type either an E or an F on my phone.
Push a button,
right. And this is what's training my eye to go toward the happy face.
That's right. So the task is simply to identify the probe as fast as you possibly can.
Gotcha.
But the threatening face and the neutral face appear at the same time, you see.
Right.
But if the probes are appearing after the positive or the neutral face, that is, say, away from the other one, you then are retraining the person's attention, the sort of automatic attention, retraining their brain to shift towards the neutral.
So the idea is that, like, I could be sitting in, if I'm a socially anxious person, I could be sitting in my dentist's office, I have time to kill, I spend a couple of minutes mm-hmm. training my brain with your software, and that cumulatively ultimately helps me to be a less anxious person. Has your research indicated that that would, you know, work?
Well, what we did, we did a large trial of over 300 subjects, a large study where we tested them on various measures of social anxiety and worry, both before and after 4 weeks of this training. People would do three of these sessions a day, which last about 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes per session. It's very quick, but they had a lot of practice over the span of 4 weeks. And we assessed them later, and we found that compared to the group that did not get the treatment, the other groups did much better. Their social anxiety had, in fact, mm-hmm. diminished. This also happened in a condition, however, where we did not have the probes always following the positive faces. So it was a little. We're still doing
okay.
more research on this here to understand exactly what's going on.
Sure.
But the groups that got the training did, in fact, show significant declines in social anxiety. So there's some promise to this procedure, but it still needs a lot more research to replicate it.
Okay, totally cool example and, you know, a million miles away from Run Tracker. Stephen Antilli, who's here in the studio with us, professor of computer information science and health science at Northeastern University. I want to ask you this question, and then also, Richard, you could chime in here. What about regulation? If you were both developing weight loss drugs or anti-anxiety medications, you'd have to go through an FDA process. Is there any analog to the FDA when it comes to mobile apps that might mess with my brain? Stephen?
That's a great question. And the government is at this point trying to figure this out, right? So where does something go from just an app that is making a sort of a wellness recommendation to something that's more diagnostic? And I think it's up for discussion. And there's a lot of interest in it because there are many apps that aren't getting created more in the health medical area because of concern of companies of sort of going into the space and essentially having a computer make a diagnosis, which it can't really do.
Richard McNally, you're a psych professor at Harvard, so I think you probably know what you're doing, but are you a little worried that there are people out there making apps that might make some kind of health promises, and the people making them don't know what they're doing, and they could hurt people in some way?
Well, that's certainly true with psychotherapies in general.
Yeah.
A lot of the therapies that are available out there in the market are not, in fact, evidence-based. I mean, many of them, such as cognitive behavior therapies for social anxiety and other problems, are, in fact, quite evidence-based. On the other hand, that's not always the case. And so people are hanging out their shingle. They may be fully licensed, but what they're actually practicing may not, in fact, have the science behind it. And so this problem is quite pervasive.
Let's take a call concerning mental health. Marion from Foxborough. Hi, Marion.
I'm calling because I have a son who has Asperger's syndrome. He's 13. And I would love to see an app that would help him with some of his core deficits. A couple of those would be, one, what we call the hidden curriculum. So these are things that people without autism would typically learn just kind of by osmosis. So, for example, how do I behave when I go into a little kid birthday party versus an adult birthday party versus a wedding? So they're all parties, but you behave differently depending on the situation. And I would love for him to be able to have an app that would say, okay, you know, here's the situation I'm going into. What are the social rules?
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Antilli, do you see some potential there?
I do, and I think the future of this type of thing is the phone knowing more and more about the context in which the person is. And so, you know, the challenge there is figuring out, you know, what should happen? Where am I going into a party setting, or am I going into a work setting or a school setting? That's sort of the first part of the problem. And then the second part is, okay, now what do I do? How do I provide feedback that the person's going to respond to? And I think, you know, in areas of autism and Asperger's, we have projects at Northeastern. One is in collaboration with Matthew Goodwin that I've worked on, where we're trying to help children with autism by having the phone automatically detect some of the behaviors, the movements that they do, flapping and rocking sort of hand movements, so that in a classroom setting, a teacher might be able to both simultaneously monitor a bunch of children and also have the device in some way give them real-time feedback that might help them reduce those particular movements, so that in a social setting, they're not perceived as being sort of out of place, which is a concern for many of the kids and their parents.
Go ahead, Richard.
Yes, I should mention that such an app exists. Philip Kendall is a professor of psychology at Temple University, and he specializes chiefly in anxiety problems in children. But he and some of his other colleagues at Temple have, in fact, developed an app that sounds very, very similar to the one that the caller was saying ought to be developed. And so she might want to contact him at Temple University in Philadelphia.
Good tip. We're talking about behavior modification via app here on Radio Boston. And up to this point, we've been focusing on health apps, but that's not the only area. One Cambridge startup targets ego-conscious behavior instead. The company is called Practically Green. Its founder and CEO, Susan Hunt Stevens, joins us in the studio tonight. Susan, pleasure to have you.
Great to be here.
With weight loss or fitness, I can get on a scale and measure how many pounds I've shed, or I can count how many more miles I can run, but how do you measure how green a person is?
Well, that is one of the biggest challenges in sustainability. And some of the tools, like carbon calculators, would be like standing on a scale and saying, what do my bones weigh? It's not something that means anything to people. And so what we had to do was bring in some principles from interactive technology, chiefly what's known as gamification, to create a framework to help people understand the impact of the different actions they're taking on a scale, like a point scale, similar to Weight Watchers, actually, or the LEAD system. And then we had to be able to monitor progress, so level up, and then we can do some really fun sharing, comparisons, rewards, and recognitions with the social norms. Because I think that's another thing we haven't talked about that phones can do, and that's bring in the power of the community that's around you to share, compare, motivate, inspire, challenge, etc.
And just like Weight Watchers, where like a donut is so many X points, I've got a list here of the how you sort of figure this for your app. Organize a neighborhood cleanup day, that's 10 points.
Mm-hmm.
Use a no VOC non-toxic paint, that gets you a whopping 75 points. Use a car wash that participates in the Water Savers program, 10 points. That must have taken a long time to figure out.
We actually have a staff scientist, and all of our points are based on the life cycle assessments across energy, water, environmental health, and waste to determine the point values, because people don't necessarily know that something like being a weekday vegetarian is highly impactful on energy. They think, oh, it's just this little thing. It's actually one of the most impactful things you can do.
And you mentioned that there's, you know, by calculating this stuff into your phone and then putting it onto a network where people can look at how green other people are, you start leveraging peer pressure, essentially.
Basically, the power of social norms, or as Cialdini calls it, flocking and norming. And so this principle in behavior science really does influence people, particularly where a social norm would be invisible. If I went to your house, I wouldn't know if you had R40 in your walls or a micro-cogen system in your basement or if that chicken's organic or local. You can't tell.
Right.
And so for things that are otherwise invisible, this transparency through social norms and the ability to say, hey, 85% of your friends converted to e-bullying, why don't you, can be really powerful. But the other piece of it is often there's questions. One of the biggest things we hear from people who are making choices is, I know I want to change this, install a rain barrel. I don't know which one is good, or I don't know which one is safe or healthy. And so there's companies out there like Good Guide, et cetera, who have created mobile apps that we integrate with Practically Green so that we can see how safe something is, how good something is when you're out shopping, what people think of it, to get people over that hump and get them into that next step.
Stephen and Tilly from Northeastern, what are your thoughts on kind of these competitive-based behavior modification apps? Is it good for life to be a game?
Well, there are some people who respond to competitive game-like things, and there are some people who may respond more to supportive types of games. And so this is one area where I think we need more research and understanding long-term. If you're competing in a game and you're succeeding, then, you know, it may be a lot of fun. If you're competing in a game and you're failing, everybody else is getting healthy and you're typically not, your reaction to that may be to disengage. And so one of the challenges here for researchers is to figure out not only how do we create something that somebody's going to use for a short period of time and it might be fun and it might be fun to compete with my friends or my family, but then after I've been using it for a couple weeks or a couple months, and the really hard one is a couple of years, if I'm not succeeding, how does it change around? How does it adapt itself so that it's reacting to me in the type of situation that I respond to? And that may not be competition. That may be getting support in various ways from friends and family.
Well, it's crazy new territory. We'll see how it all shakes up. This has been a great conversation. Thank you all for participating. Stephen Antilli is a professor of commuter and information science and health sciences at Northeastern University. Richard McNally is a professor in the psychology department at Harvard. Susan Hunt Stevens, founder and CEO of Practically Green. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we're going to talk sports with Only a Game's Bill Littlefield. Plus, we're going to take you to an art exhibit that you actually need a kayak to get to. Stay with us. I'm Adam Ragusa with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.